Get energized and excited to tell the world, hey, you can call me Catholic. Live from the Christ Cathedral Campus in Garden Grove, California, EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network and Orange County Catholic Radio present Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normanton.
Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, if there is any excellence and if there is anything worthy of praise, let that be your inspiration and your focus. St. Paul says we should think about these things. And thinking about things alone really doesn't make for very good radio. So we're going to talk about them too. That is our mission every week here on Call Me Catholic, talking about the good stuff. I am Peggy Normanton, and you have arrived at Call Me Catholic, a light and hopefully lively hour of conversation intended to affirm, explore, and celebrate our Catholic identity in these modern times. So we can each wake up and say to the world every single day, oh yeah, you can call me Catholic. Now, one of the good things in my immediate vision is my engineer and chief fact checker, Jimmy G. He's kind of my co-pilot for every hour, sitting right across from me.
Something else that makes for great radio is silencing our cell phones.
Am I not doing that?
No.
Is that an admonition?
When you were starting, I thought, what's that buzz noise? Is that my phone?
Oh, what? And it was.
No, I don't think it was. I think it was my imagination.
You got a lot buzzing on up there,
yes,
Jimmy
I do.
G. Hey, are you watching the Winter Games? Are you enjoying the Olympics in Pyeongchang?
I've caught several highlights. It's usually like a highlight through the news feed. That's how I watch.
Yeah, well, you're such a sports fan. I thought you would be following it avidly.
I'm a baseball guy.
I know.
Sports scene.
Okay. Well, right. And the purists would say that the Winter Games aren't as athletically, you know, classic as the summer games. But, you know, that may be true, but they are still very, very thrilling. And these athletes are so rugged and so graceful. Now, the luge, you know, the luge, which is when they get into those like little rockets and they go straight down. That is the one that just takes my breath away. So much speed and so much faith in your instrument.
Yeah.
And it was very cool that 29-year-old young man was the first American to medal in the luge.
Amazing.
That wasn't an implicitly American sport, the luge.
Yeah.
But boy, he couldn't have surprised himself more by medaling. He got a silver.
Where do you find a practice course for places like that?
That's a really good question. Yeah. Not every backyard has a luge course.
Not every YMCA.
Well, you certainly couldn't do it here because we don't have any snow. We don't even have anything chilling. But anyway, it's what's really fun are those sort of surprise moments when somebody doesn't expect to win and they win.
Exactly.
And we can always use these events as metaphors for our faith. The life of a true Christian isn't just a matter of coasting or cruising along effortlessly. Living the way God would have us live is a real struggle. It takes relentless discipline to keep sin out of our lives. It's something we have to strive for with great zeal and energy, with every ounce of spiritual strength and determination we have, just as an Olympic-class athlete urges and pushes his body onto achievement. Now, St. Paul knew that because he used the games and a lot of other athletic metaphors with his audience to explain spiritual principles.
That's
he tells
right.
us to try to win that race. That's the goal. And we're all cheering each other on across the finish line together, right? We're all going to be the winners.
Amen.
Hey, so you know that Jimmy G and I are coming to you not from the grandstands in Pyeongchang. I wish. Maybe next year. In 2 years, Jimmy G.
I don't know if that's in the budget. But anyway.
But instead, we are from high atop the Tower of Hope on the Christ Cathedral campus in Orange County, California. We are not home to any Olympic Games, but we are a very culturally diverse and growing community of Catholics. We have a couple of local athletes, actually, from Orange County who are competing in the Winter Olympics in South Korea.
No surprise.
An ice hockey player from Ladera Ranch.
Mm.
And then also a bobsled guy from my hometown, Newport Beach.
Wow.
So go USA, but good luck to all the athletes out there. In the course of every Olympic Games, there's always the miracle moments, you know, in sports. Well, you certainly see that in baseball.
Yes, you do.
Miracle moments, you know, when somebody hits a home run and they're not expecting to, or when a skater nails that impossible triple axel on the ice, or a snowboarder reaches unbelievable heights in his half pipe. We call them miracles, but they are really just the result of remarkable training. No accident, really, and no surprise, considering the amount of time they have spent working for that one moment. Miracles, in the Catholic context, are by definition marvelous, improbable events that are not explicable by natural or scientific laws, and therefore are considered to be the work of God alone. And I think that is a subject worthy of discussion, the miracles in our faith. And we have a guest coming on who has a very niche knowledge of that aspect of our faith, not a mandatory aspect of our faith, mind you, believing in miracles. But nevertheless, the Catholic Church takes claims of miracles very, very seriously. because the church doesn't want people misled or participating in superstitions. And the church is likewise very cognizant that God continues to speak to his humanity through supernatural occurrences that you may choose or not choose to believe. Well, our guest, Michael O'Neill, is the definitive miracle hunter. He has his own show on Relevant Radio, appropriately called Miracle Hunter, and he's a frequent guest on EWTN programs because of his expert knowledge of Marian apparitions and the miracles associated, all the miracles associated with them. So he will be with us to discuss the latest medical miracle confirmed from Lourdes, France, on this 160th anniversary of the appearance of Mary to sweet St. Bernadette. He'll be up in a minute with some good conversation for us, Michael O'Neill. And then we are going to revisit a testimony I recorded several years ago of a woman and her husband describing their experience at Lourdes. An appropriate follow-up, I think, to our interview with Michael O'Neill. But first up, it is our Call Me Catholic countdown of the week, which is going to be my top five favorite miracles that Jesus performed during his public life. And of course, as we enter into Lent, this is the first Saturday of Lent, we prepare to consider again the many miracles Jesus performed for people, and some he actually chose not to perform. And they were an attest to God's goodness and mercy, and there is something to learn from every single one of them. These were not random acts of his power. No, there were very, very important lessons and models for us to observe. So here we go, our Call Me Catholic countdown of the week.
The Call Me Catholic countdown.
Well, I thought we were going to go with the mellow one.
Usually when I go with the mellow ones, you're disappointed. But I thought, you know, this is Lent. So.
Well, and these miracles were proactive. I mean, there's nothing passive about them. So they're full of action and mystery and excitement. So
for the remainder of Lent, I'll do the mellow one.
No, not necessarily. I like to tease you about that. Okay, so everybody has their favorite miracles, and we never tire of hearing the account of them in the Gospels. But because this is my show, I get to list my top five favorite ones. So here we are, my top five favorite miracles that Jesus performed during his public ministry. So I'm going to say number five would be the raising of Lazarus. Maybe because it showed Jesus' humanity as having this friend, this family that he was so close to. Mm-hmm. The story is told in the 11th chapter of John's Gospel, and we hear it a lot at funeral masses because the raising of Lazarus was a sign of Christ's power over death. He is the life who destroys the wall that can seem so insurmountable to us, the wall of death. And this is a miracle that is so rich in wonderment and, like I said, in Christ's humanity. These are his friends. These are his friends. And when Martha implores Jesus to bring her brother back to life, we know we need to model Martha's faith in the midst of doubts and fears we might encounter in the face of tragedies, especially in the face of death. So when Jesus asked Martha if she believed that he was the resurrection and the life, she replied, "Yes, Lord, I have come to believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, the one who is coming into the world." So I think that's such a beautiful exchange. And then, of course, Lazarus coming back to life. It's just absolutely astounding what that must have felt like to the people who observed that. Okay, I'm going to say number four is when Jesus walked on water. He walked on the lake. He walked on water toward the boat that held his disciples. And there was storms and winds swirling around. And, of course, they first thought he was a ghost, and then they recognized that it was Jesus, and he beckons them, come to me. Right. And, of course, Peter, great zealous Peter, he starts right out on the water believing that he can do it. He starts walking on the water, and then the winds swirl around him, and he doubts, and he starts to sink. And, of course, he starts flailing, as any of us would in those circumstances. And Jesus says, "Oh, you have little faith, why did you doubt me?" So it's one of those things we can relate to as human beings. We are full of doubt. We have no reason to doubt Jesus. He's right there in front of us. He's right there beckoning us, but we do. And as a result, we fall short of witnessing a miracle as a result of that or being part of a miracle. Okay. Number three will be the man born blind. Now, the man, first of all, to be born blind, this is a grown man. He has never had the experience of vision.
Right.
So to experience that must have been simply stupendous, you know, and the light and but what was cool is that he recognized the voice of Jesus. He didn't see Jesus, but he recognized the God in his voice. And so he asks Jesus to cure him. And Jesus doesn't just cure him. He says, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam."
Right.
So there was a certain amount of obedience that had to follow Jesus' directive in order for the miracle to happen. And I think that is true in our life too, that sometimes Jesus, we ask for miracles, we ask for prayers to be answered, and Jesus says, "Do this."
There's some follow through.
Yeah, a little follow through. A few directions. Okay, so number two would be, now this is a miracle that Jesus performed during his passion. Now, Peter, in the Garden of Gethsemane, in anger and in defense of Jesus, cuts off the ear of one of the servants of the high priest Caiaphas to prevent him from arresting Jesus. And we can totally relate to Peter doing that, both out of anger and out of defense and just out of the sheer moment of instinct, human instinct, you know, when he drew his sword.
Mm-hmm.
And what does Jesus do? Jesus instantly replaces the ear and repairs the wound of the servant. And this is his way of living out his command to us to love our enemies. So his miracles were not just for his friends. I mean, he was an equal employment opportunity miracle distributor. But this really illustrates, perhaps better than any of his other miracles, that they were lessons and there were truths implicit in all of these works. Okay, I am going to say now that my number one favorite miracle at this point in my life that Jesus performed was the miracle at Cana. The turning of the water into wine. Now, I have, this is personal for me because I have we have a wedding this year in our family. Our son is getting married in July. So we're very, very excited about that. And we certainly do hope there's enough wine for all the guests. But I actually attended a wedding where it was a friend's wedding, a friend's daughter's wedding. And they had given their daughter the budget to do the wedding. They said, here, you wanted to plan your own wedding, you plan your own wedding. Well, when it came to the reception, she and her groom decided, well, we just need beer and maybe a few bottles of wine. Well, the wine ran out before 10 guests had arrived.
Wow.
They were thinking like college students, right? So the father of the bride had to go out and buy wine. We didn't take time to pray that the beer be turned into wine, but but we did feel for the bride's father, and I think he felt like he was in a pinch. So we all know that a special celebration like a wedding, you know, certainly requires the amount of wine that all the guests can enjoy, and toast to the bride and groom. That's part of the ceremony. And Jesus understood that. And here's the other thing I like about this miracle is that so many of the other miracles in that historical setting, we have to kind of adapt to modern settings to understand, like the leper or the woman at the well, things like that. But a wedding is a wedding is a wedding.
Right.
It's a celebratory gathering of friends, and everybody's happy, and everybody wants to be a part of this positive emotional experience and launch this couple off into a beautiful marriage. So Jesus certainly understood that, and his mother certainly understood that. So I love that. That's got to be my number one favorite miracle that Jesus performed during his ministry. Are you good with those, Jimmy?
Those are good. I was thinking, I've never been to a potluck wedding before. But
the Midwest has quite a few of them, I think. I think that's fairly common, yeah.
I'm okay with it.
Yeah. I mean, as long as you bring your very, very best dish.
Right.
Yeah, and enough for everybody.
Right.
Okay, so there you have it. My top five favorite of Jesus' miracles. Today, these are my favorite. Ask me in a week, and I may choose five different ones. But if I have made you think about the personal lessons and inspirations you have derived from dwelling in the mystery of the many miracles Jesus performed, then the Call Me Catholic Countdown has achieved its purpose, its very lofty purpose. Now, friends, I want to remind you to check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/callmecatholic. It is a perfect way to share the show with your friends and family whom you think might enjoy hearing us. We are beginning to Facebook Live stream the show, but not this week. Next week, you can return to watching the show live on our Facebook page or on the EWTN Facebook page. But you can also just check out the page, give us a like, follow us, and we'll keep you posted, apprised of all our program content. Michael O'Neill is coming up next. He's the Miracle Hunter, and he's going to tell us about the latest medical miracle confirmed from the Lourdes Shrine during this 160th anniversary of Mary's appearance to Bernadette there. So stay with us. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to Call Me Catholic on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
This is a Lenten Journey with Timothy Cardinal Dolan on EWTN Radio.
And leaving everything behind, he got up and followed him. That's the response of Levi to the summons, the invitation of Jesus in today's gospel for this Saturday after Ash Wednesday. Jesus calls all of us to leave something behind. And Lent, my friends, is a providential time to acknowledge what that is and then to do it. Now look, we've all got something to leave behind. It might be anger or bitterness or lust or drink. Jesus knows it. We know it. We're better off without it, folks. And we can't unreservedly follow him until we leave that behind. Lent's the time to answer the invitation of Jesus to leave things behind and follow him.
A Lenten Journey with Timothy Cardinal Dolan is available on DVD through the EWTN Religious Catalog. This DVD includes all 47 segments for each day of Lent, from Ash Wednesday to Easter Sunday. To get your copy, log on to our website, EWTNReligiousCatalog.com, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Podcasting is an easy way to automatically receive your favorite EWTN programs on your mobile device. Visit EWTN.com/podcast and enjoy your favorite EWTN shows on your mobile phone right now.
Father Larry Richards.
God is the God of life. God is the God of love. So when we conform our life to His life and His will, it's always life-giving. Always.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
Helping you navigate the daily struggles and blessings of life. This is Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Well, hello there, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to Call Me Catholic this Saturday. I am your host, Peggy Normandin. And today we are exploring the spiritual landscape of miracles in our faith. We are going to hear a lot throughout this Lenten season about the many miracles Jesus performed during his public ministry. In fact, there are 37 miracles recorded in the four Gospels, the most being documented in Mark's Gospel. But miracles continue to abound in our modern world. Many are recorded and confirmed toward the canonization of our communion of saints. Some are through Marian apparitions that have occurred around the world. Some are Eucharistic miracles that defy science. Some are just personal episodes that speak to us of God's mighty power and desire to touch us with his love and mercy. Michael O'Neill knows about them all. That is his field of expertise. He is known as the miracle hunter because he has made his profession out of studying and pursuing all these different kinds of miracles that attest to the supernatural power of God. He has on his show Relevant Radio discussed these subjects because his show is called Miracle Hunter, and that happens to be the name of his website as well. He's a frequent and popular guest on EWTN programs as well as other secular news channels, and he's published several books on the subject. Michael O'Neill knows his stuff, and his stuff happens to be miracles. Welcome to Call Me Catholic, Michael.
Hey, thanks so much for that kind introduction.
Well, and it's only scratching the surface of your great depth of knowledge and experience. So, Michael, we are in the midst right now of the 160th anniversary of Mary's appearance to St. Bernadette at Lourdes, and it coincides right now, that anniversary coincides with yet another medical miracle that has been confirmed through the intercession of Mary at Lourdes.
Yeah, that's right. There have been many cures that have followed those apparitions to St. Bernadette Subaru, the 14-year-old French girl who dug into the ground at the request of the Virgin Mary in those apparitions, and a healing spring came forth, and people began to bathe in that spring, and there were so many miracles that were being reported immediately when that spring came forth that they established this medical commission. It's called the CAMIL, the International Lourdes Medical Commission, and they want to validate whether these are, in fact, scientifically inexplicable. And throughout history, there have been some 7,000 remarkable cures that have been documented as part of that study, but only 69, and now number 70, has been declared completely scientifically inexplicable, declared a miracle at Lourdes.
Okay, so let me stop you right there. What is the difference then? What distinguishes these now 70 medical miracles from the thousands that you said have actually occurred, or we believe have occurred through a person's pilgrimage to Lourdes?
So they use an extremely strict criteria, and it's a little bit of an older criteria. It was put together by Prospero Lambertini, an Italian cardinal who later became Pope Benedict XIV. And he wrote all the miracle requirements to be used in canonizations and beatifications. And he said that the cures need to be instantaneous, complete, and permanent. Oh. And there can be no medical treatment given that relates to the cure. Of course, it must be a serious condition. It can't be a cold that just goes away. But so he wrote those criteria, you know, a couple centuries ago.
Yeah.
And we're still using them in today's church when everybody seeks medical treatment. And so part of that catches that if you did receive medical treatment and it didn't work, then that's a possibility to be used. But in the case where medical treatment might be the cause for, you know, you getting better, the Catholic Church will say perhaps God is working through medicine,
right?
But that's not going to be one of the ones we certify at Lourdes. So there are a number of cases, and perhaps my favorite case, I talked to somebody, a member of the Medical Lewis Commission, and I said, give me an example of a case that you thought was really remarkable but didn't pass muster. And he said there was an older woman, a grandmother, in fact, who was blind due to macular degeneration.
Mm-hmm.
And she went to Lourdes and prayed to Mary. She said, give me my sight in order that I might see my grandchildren and pray with them just one day. And then you can take away my sight. And sure enough, she went in the Lourdes bath and she came out and her vision was restored. And of course, in great Thanksgiving, she prayed with her grandchildren and celebrated that miracle. And her eyesight has been fine ever since. But when the scientists looked at it, they found that her vision was restored, but the macula or the elements of her eye that were distorted did not grow back. She was seeing despite having damaged retinas or whatever it was in her eye that wasn't working. So that's miraculous in its own way, but because the pathology didn't restore, it was not considered an official Lourdes miracle. So there are many cases like this where they're absolutely remarkable, but they don't pass that very strict standard that the church uses.
Well, that it was very fortuitous that who was it? Did you say Pope? One of the popes established this medical criteria?
Yeah, Pope Benedict the 14th, when he was Prospero Lambertini, a cardinal, he wrote all the rules, and they've been in place ever since. And that Lambertini criteria is the same exact criteria used for canonization and at Lourdes itself.
Well, what I think is so brilliant about that is before all these medical advancements in science have come to pass in the last 100, 200 years, you know, you could look back on a miracle and sort of say, oh, well, yes, but maybe this happened. We have much more knowledge. We have much more expertise in these areas. So he was really pretty prophetic to say nothing that science can bring into the picture will change our definition of a medical miracle.
That's right. And of course, they have to go by the current medical standards at the time to say what science can say at that time. But, you know, they may, you know, I like to joke that it's a little bit of a miracle every time they find a miracle at Lourdes or in canonization causes, because it's so impossible. They make the criteria so strict.
Well, let's talk about this 70th medical miracle that was given to a nun who visited Lourdes on the 150th anniversary of the apparition in 2008.
That's right. Her name is Sister Bernadette, appropriately, Morneau. And she's somebody who had a number of back surgeries for her spine. She had severe spinal problems. And I think she had something like 5 surgeries in 7 years. And despite those surgeries, it left her completely debilitated. And she was declared to be in a permanent state of disability. And she went to Lourdes, and she was, resigned to living in a wheelchair. And according to her own testimony, she didn't really go there to Lourdes to pray for that miracle to happen to her, but she did go through the Lourdes baths and went through that whole process. And when she came home, she had an incredible experience. She felt some heat or some feeling of goodness, as she called it, or her health radiating through her body. And sure enough, she was able to get up and walk. And not only walk, but the reports say that she walked a 5-kilometer walk shortly after that happened.
I mean, it's
not just, she felt a little bit better. She went out to prove that it was real, and she went through that whole process over the course of close to 10 years. They always like to see that it's a permanent cure, that your body just didn't snap back into place a little bit, then go back. So they've been watching her case, through medical study over all these years, and she's still fine. So it's an incredible healing, and definitely one that passes all the strict criteria.
Well, and I loved her disposition, because she said she went to confession and received the anointing of the sick during this pilgrimage. And now I quote her. She says, "In no case did I ask for healing, but only for the conversion of heart and the strength to continue my journey as an invalid." So I think that is such a beautiful attitude to bring to the shrine. And I think sometimes invalids just feel this solidarity with other, I think they call them les invalides or les malades. With this great fellowship with all these other people who are suffering, and you find strength in that. And sometimes that in itself is a bit of a miracle, but certainly not one that would pass the medical examination, medical council for Lourdes or for the Vatican. But yeah, I thought her, I wonder if that is very influential in God's choice of how he picks these people to use as models of miracles because of the disposition they bring with them to their prayers, you know.
It could be, you know, it's one of those questions, if God lets me into heaven someday, and it's one of the first questions I'm going to ask. How do you decide who gets a miracle and who doesn't? Because it's kind of a tricky thing to find out who gets them and who doesn't. But
well, you know, Michael, the other thing I want to ask you is, in order for this to be declared a miracle that is attributed specifically to Lourdes, you have this whole council on one side that's kind of scrutinizing the miracle. What has to happen on the side of the person who received the miracle? Do they have to go through a certain protocol of having said, I dedicated this trip, I intended for this to help me, I prayed these prayers? You know, I often wonder, you know, when certain miracles are attributed to the saints, did the person follow a prescription of prayer that was specifically set aside toward that person's canonization?
So this is a great question you asked, and to be honest, having an officially recognized miracle at Lourdes is a little bit easier, if there is such a thing, than getting a miracle validated by the Vatican for a canonization cause. Because in the canonization causes, there are two distinct steps. One is the medical commission, the Consulta Romana, says that, okay, we have a case that's scientifically inexplicable. And then it goes to the next level, which is the theologian review, where they say, is this a case of singular intercession? So if you were to pray to a potential future saint and also pray to St. John Paul II and Mother Teresa, and you submitted that to Rome, Rome would say, you know, it might be that you're the new saint, potential saint, worked this miracle. But, you know, we've got St. John Paul II and Mother Teresa involved as well, so we don't know, you know, who picked up the phone when you called. You know,
so there's an exclusivity. You have to establish an exclusivity to your devotions, which is very interesting because I've often thought about that, because we do kind of skip around in our devotion to the saints.
Yeah, absolutely. I pray to all my friends, the saints, when I need some help, you know, hoping that somebody is able to help me out. So it's really tricky. And the other aspect of it is, of course, when we're sick or we're in trouble, we're not the only people typically praying for us. All our family and friends could be involved as
yes.
well. So if you were praying to one saint, but your friends were praying to another, the Vatican would never say this is a case of singular intercession, because there would be no proof who interceded. So in like these cases of Fulton Sheen or Mother Teresa,
right.
where they asked their family and friends to pray exclusively to this one potential saint, that's how the Vatican is able to say with ease that this was a singular intercession.
Wow, that takes focus. That takes focus and discipline. Okay, we are going to continue this great, great, riveting conversation with Michael O'Neill about miracles, because he is the miracle hunter, so we can't get any better than that. So stay with us, friends. We'll be right back with more conversation with Michael O'Neill in just a minute. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to Call Me Catholic on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
A Lenten Reflection with Father Dominic Legge.
In this season of Lent, we look to Christ on the cross to be our Savior. And being conformed to Christ on the cross is one of the most important things we can do this Lent. If you want an example of the virtues of the Christian life, you'll find them most perfectly in Jesus on the cross. An example of charity, because greater love than this no one has, to lay down his life for his friends. And that's what Jesus did for us. An example of patience. Christ, who was perfectly innocent, but who took up the suffering of the cross for our sake. Humility, the one who is all-powerful, who humbled himself and became obedient even unto death. And, of course, obedience to the Father's will. How about contempt for earthly pleasures? Jesus left behind all the good things of this life because he knew of the power of eternal life that he obtained for us on the cross. Let us be conformed to Christ this Lent.
When you deal with God, get out of the way.
The incomparable Mother Angelica. She broke the mold of Catholic teaching with her one-of-a-kind perspective. From her spunky spiritual growth talks to her eye-opening scripture study, a nun like none other.
I intend to scare the hell out of you.
She was the one, the only, the non-forgettable Mother Angelica. Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio and Television.
EWTN. teaching the truth.
I love your show. I was raised in a Southern Baptist environment, in and out of church since I was a teenager. But since listening to your show the last several months, I'm in the process of converting to Catholicism.
Ever since I started listening, I've been learning a lot, and I've been very intrigued by some of the things you guys discuss. I want to learn more, and I have a thirst for learning.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Celebrating, exploring, and restoring our Catholic identity. This is Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normanton.
Hello, friends, and thank you for staying with us on this really, really interesting conversation on the subject of miracles. We have an expert in the house leading our journey into the mystery and marvel of miracles of the Marian variety and every other kind as well. Michael O'Neill is the definitive miracle hunter. He manages a website called Just That, and he's frequently sought out for his insight into a knowledge of the history of miracles in our faith, their relevance, and their meaning. In fact, in 2015, National Geographic featured a cover story on how the Virgin Mary became the most powerful woman in the world, and Michael O'Neill was the source of their featured article. So I'm really fascinated about that, Michael. Tell me how that played out for you in 2015 and how National Geographic came to feature Mary on the cover of one of their issues.
Well, it was so fascinating. And as you might imagine, it was one of the absolute highlights of my work, my life's work as the miracle hunter, to be featured on National Geographic. And I think if somebody had asked me, you know, can you pick any magazine you'd love to have a story about Marian apparitions on, I would pick that one. So it was really a dream come true in so many ways.
Well, because it's also historical, which they're granting by putting it on National Geographic. This is history. This isn't just somebody's fancy.
Exactly. This is, you know, of course, they're a science, history, culture magazine. So the fact that they would put an article about Mary is big time. And I think one of the exciting thing is that it became the number one best-selling National Geographic in 6 years. That's how well received it was.
Is that right? That is really very compelling. I love that. That makes me very happy.
Yeah, I was so excited to be a part of it. And Maureen Orth, the author, she had been talking with one of the executive editors of the magazine, who she had met at an exhibit on the Virgin Mary in Washington, D.C., and they kind of drummed up this idea and said, you know, maybe we should do an article. And that kind of went from there. And Maureen Orth gave me a call at the request of the International Marian Research Institute at the University of Dayton. They said, you've got to talk to this miracle hunter guy. And Maureen Orth and I hit it off, and we worked together on that article.
So tell me what that article covered and how they approached it. What angle did they approach it from as Mary becoming one of the most powerful women in world history?
So it's so interesting because, you know, they looked at it from sort of a objective or scientific or cultural point of view, in the sense of they broke down some of the numbers of how many people go on Marian pilgrimages, how much mm-hmm. money is spent, you know, how many people are culturally attached to the Virgin Mary. And but beyond that, I love this, that Maureen Orth did this, but she put a huge focus on Our Lady of Guadalupe and Our Lady of Lourdes and Fatima. She traveled around the world, these very famous apparition sites, Our Lady of Cabejo in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. She went to Medjugorje. But she put the highlight on Marian apparitions, which I absolutely loved, of course. And they contacted me as well to do the map, which is a two-page spread in the magazine of all the apparitions throughout history. They took all my Miracle Hunter data and categorized it as approved, ongoing, condemned, et cetera, uh-huh. and mapped them out, in these dots. And it's really kind of, for people who love Marian apparitions, that was really a fun thing.
What was the first Marian apparition?
So the first Marian apparition is considered to be in 40 A.D., St. James in Saragossa, Spain. And you might do a little math and say, wait a minute, 40 A.D., Mary is still alive in that case.
Yeah.
But it's believed that Mary bilocated and appeared to St. James, who was despairing when he was trying to spread the faith in Spain. And she appeared to him and encouraged him to continue on. And, of course, he's one of the great saints in our Catholic Church history. So that is considered the very first, 40 A.D. in Saragossa, Spain.
And so they listed that then in the National Geographic.
Absolutely. And, of course, there's sort of an interesting phenomena when you look at history of Marian apparitions, because starting in the Council of Trent, which is about 1545 to 1563, the Church began to institute a strict investigative process. We talked about investigating healing miracles, but apparitions likewise have a very strict process. But prior to 1545, all the apparitions in history that occurred before that went through more of a sort of a pastoral approach where the local bishop, the local parish priest, perhaps even the faithful, they looked at an apparition and said, does this seem believable?
So they started the vetting process.
Exactly. But it didn't go through, you know, talking to scientists, to theologians, to Mariologists, psychologists like they do today. It was a, you know, less intense process. And so we know people who wear the brown scapular, for example. That mm-hmm. happened in 1251 in Aylesford, England, to St. Simon Stock. So that was before the investigative process. So even though it's one of the most highly recognized of all Marian apparitions, it was never right. It was never investigated. So there's definitely a separation between the ones that are investigated and the ones that are sort of traditional in their sense of approval.
Do all of the apparition sites have miracles associated with them? I mean, the apparition itself is obviously a miracle, a supernatural occurrence. But do they subsequently have many, many miracles associated with each one of the apparition sites?
It's a great question. And Lourdes, of course, is the most famous places for miracles. And other places, even like the controversial site of Medjugorje, have many miracles being reported. But in the 1978 document, The Norms of the Congregation for Discerning Alleged Private Revelations and Apparitions, they list miracles, healing miracles and such, as some of the good fruit, such as vocations, conversions, medical healings, etc. So that's one of the things that the church looks at when they give an approval to an apparition. Has there been good fruit that's come out of this apparition? It's not a requirement, and there are some cases where there aren't a lot of medical healings, but more often than not, it's a sign of a true apparition when medical healings are found.
We're talking about Marian apparitions, and there are so many medical miracles associated with them, but there are many other kinds of miracles of the heart, miracles of conversion, miracles that cannot be documented or scientifically, explained in a formula type thing. So there are so many other miracles than those that make the history books. Let's talk, though, about the only one so far that's occurred in the United States. And actually, in 2010, you were the expert commentator during the live broadcast of the media coverage of the first and only apparition approval of a Marian apparition in the United States, which it was in Champion, Wisconsin. A lot of American Catholics don't know about this.
That's right. And if you go to that shrine there, which is in Champion, Wisconsin, formerly Robinsonville, and it's just outside of Green Bay, it is a very simple shrine. I just went on a pilgrimage to Lourdes last year, and that's really the Disneyland of Catholicism when you go. The shrine is amazing. And the amount of people who go every year, the procession or parade, as you might make an analogy, there is incredible. When you go to Champion, Wisconsin, it is so simple and so peaceful that, it really belies the idea that not many people know about it.
Well, what is
the
story?
Numbers are increasing.
Remind our listeners, or tell our listeners who might be hearing this for the first time, what is the story of the apparition there in Champion?
So in the year 1858, there was this Belgian farm worker. Her name was Adele Bryce, and she was actually consecrated to the Virgin Mary. They didn't have an order of nuns there, but in Belgium, I think before she came to the United States, she had made that promise to become a nun. But on her way to the grist mill, the grain mill, she experienced a vision of the Virgin Mary, who she didn't know was Mary at first. And then three subsequent apparitions later, she was able to speak to Mary and learn who it was. And sort of the message that came out of those apparitions was a message of catechesis of the young, which is a mm-hmm. message important in today's world.
Mm-hmm. So how long did it take before the Vatican approved that and sanctioned it as an actual authentic Marian site?
That is the interesting part, because it happened in 1858, 12 years to the date of that apparition. There's considered this great Peshtigo fire, the largest fire in the history of the United States. It was the same date as the Chicago fire, and it took so many lives. The one place that was spared in this huge swath of land in Wisconsin was the Our Lady of Good Help Shrine, where they paraded an image of Our Lady of Good Help around the perimeter, and the fire burned all the way up to the edge of the property, but did not burn the shrine. So when they went through this investigative process, which happened probably, it started in around 2005 and then ended in 2010, they looked at that as one of the great miracles, in addition to some healing miracles and the truth of the apparition. So it took, the Catholic Church moves like a glacier sometimes with different things, and this is a case in point. Happened in 1858. approved in 2010 by Bishop David L. Ricken of Green Bay. So it takes many years oftentimes for this to get approved.
So if I may be sort of a devil's advocate here, Michael O'Neill, Miracle Hunter, what do you think, if you have studied these throughout history, as you said, the first one being 40 A.D., what is the point? Is there a reoccurring theme? Is there a message that continues to repeat itself in all these apparitions that Mary is trying to impose on the human race? What is the ultimate message here? What is the point, if I could be so common?
Absolutely, and that is the number one question to ask. I think when I first started studying Marian apparitions and built the website miraclehunter.com, I was so interested about which were the approved ones, what has the church said, what is the process. But really, when you step away from it, the important takeaway is, why does this happen? Mm-hmm. That's the point of it all. And, really, Mary comes to us as a mother. You know, there have been so many times of great famine, war, apostasy, you know, people needing their mother throughout history, where Mary has come to their aid. So it really affirms the role of Mary as mother. But most importantly of all, rather than getting too wrapped up in, you know, the spectacle of the miracle, this draws us closer to Christ. It inspires our faith. It draws us closer to her son. So that's the real point. You know, she talks about prayer, conversion, sacrifice, penance. All those things are common themes, but those are all things reflected in the Gospels and in our own Catholic Church. So it's all really an inspiration to bring us closer to Christ.
Have you ever seen a case where a Marian apparition actually altered history? I think I know where you're going to go with this, too.
Well, there are several examples. Our Lady of Pontmain in France, where Mary appeared in 1871 ahead of the end of the Franco-Prussian War. People talk about that having a role. Of course, the Battle of Lepanto, while it's not an apparition, you know, Our Lady
the Holy Rosary.
The Holy Rosary was involved, all of Europe praying for the end to that battle. But you don't have to go any further than Our Lady of Guadalupe, Mexico, 1531.
Bingo.
Some people call it the greatest event in the history of the Western Hemisphere. I mean, it had so many conversions, and really, the United States has so many Catholics, perhaps because of Our Lady of Guadalupe herself. She was perhaps the primary evangelist of the United States, as was stated by Archbishop Gomez in Los Angeles recently. So that was the event, and it's not an event that happened, you know, some 500 years ago. You can still go to Mexico City and witness this tilma, the miraculous image of Our Lady on the tilma of the cloak of St. Juan Diego. This is a miracle that continues even to today. So I think for people who love Our Lady and want to just point to her influence, you have to go no further than Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Well, and it never has there been such enduring evidence of supernatural powers, you know, manifest on that tilt. I mean, with colors, with artistry that cannot be traced to anything other than a supernatural origin.
Absolutely. And yeah, Our Lady of Guadalupe is my patron saint, my favorite Marian title, however you want to say it. But, and I've done a lot of work with the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe on the cross and have gone to see and venerate that tilma in person. But it all began a story related to my mother, which in our family we consider to be at least a little miracle story, where my mother, when she was young, perhaps 6 or 7 years old, she went through the terrible experience of her own mother, my grandmother, falling away from the Catholic faith. And it wasn't one of these things where her mother stopped going to Mass on Sundays. She began to throw away the rosary beads and the statues in the house.
She was angry.
And insult her own children for their, you know, their piety and their devotion. And she said, why do you believe in such silly nonsense? And so my mother, who was distraught, she prayed to God and made a deal with God like any good Catholic will do. And she said, you know, God, please, through the intercession of your mother, Our Lady of Guadalupe, bring my mother back to the Catholic faith. And if you do, you know, when I grow up someday, I'm going to become a school teacher and teach every student I ever have on December 12th the story of Our Lady of Guadalupe and the miracles of the Tilma. And if you bless me with any children when I grow up, they also will hear that story of Our Lady of Guadalupe. And you can guess by, you know, the end of the story, which is I heard that story a lot every December 12th because my grandmother came back to the Catholic faith and she died a model Catholic. You know, she died a few years ago. But she was a model for us.
It's a beautiful story. And I mean, who would have thought that your mother's promise, her dialogue with God would have led to one of her sons actually being such an incredible spokesperson of knowledge and inspiration. Now, Michael, there is also another category of miracle that is fascinating and so deeply, deeply mysterious. And those are the Eucharistic miracles.
Over the years, I have been increasingly drawn to the miracles of the Eucharist. We do have these rare occasions where God has allowed it such that true flesh and true blood is made visible on a consecrated host. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons it's so exciting is because in the case of Marian apparitions, more or less, you have to rely on the good witness and testimony of the visionaries. With Eucharistic miracles, science can validate the miracle because they look at these cases and they find that not only is true flesh and true blood found on a consecrated host, but it has been found to be striated heart tissue. Not only that, but all Eucharistic miracles are found to be blood type AB, mm-hmm. which is also coincidentally, perhaps, the blood type of the Shroud of Turin.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps the most fascinating point of all is that some people may say, well, some hoaxers might put some flesh or blood on a host and leave it there for people to find. Science looks at these things, and they cannot find where the bread begins and the flesh ends. It's completely intermeshed in such a way, it's a gradient, so to speak. They can't figure out how that flesh is part of the bread. So,
I love the recent one. The most recent one that I've read about was when was in Argentina, when actually our Pope Francis was then Jorge Bergoglio, and under his jurisdiction, a priest had taken a host that had been discarded on the floor, and he was just dissolving it, as is the protocol. And when it didn't dissolve, they pursued it scientifically, and ultimately it led to them sending it to New York with absolutely no information. In other words, they gave them no information, a top laboratory in New York. Tell us what this is. And they came out with exactly what you talked about. It was, the striated tissue. It was the blood type of an AB blood type male that had been severely beaten on the chest. And those were just scientific reports with having no idea what the source of it was.
Absolutely. And that occurred in the 1990s, actually. So there was actually another one in Legnica, Poland last year that was validated and a few others in between. So this is something that's happened around the world, and not just in Italy, not just in France. Like you say, Buenos Aires, Argentina, in Poland, in India, there's been Eucharistic mm-hmm. miracles. So this is something that's happened worldwide.
We have to take notice of these things. Even though they are not imperative to having faith, they are such beautiful examples of how God is trying to reach out and talk to us. Hey, Michael, before we say goodbye, I want you to tell our listeners about a fascinating pilgrimage that you are conducting all about miracles that have gone on in Italy.
Yeah, I've been doing pilgrimages, as you know, for the last few years. And last year we were in Fatima for the 100th anniversary, and previously Lourdes and Guadalupe in Spain. But this is, for people who like miracles, this is the ultimate.
Everybody loves a miracle.
Everybody loves a miracle. But so on this trip, it's the 50th anniversary of Padre Pio's feast day. And, of course, he's the greatest modern miracle-working saint.
Absolutely.
But in addition, we'll be going to the feast day of St. Januarius, which famously is the place where the relic of the blood of St. Mm-hmm. Januarius liquefies every year on his feast day. And so we're going to be there to see that in person, which is incredible. But we'll also be going to Assisi, the place of the first stigmata, Lanciano, the place of the first Eucharistic miracle. We're going to be seeing St. Cecilia, the first incorrupt body. We're going to Loreto and the Veronica Vale and Lanciano. We're going to all the incredible places of miracles in Italy. So not only Padre Pio, but it's amazing. And people can sign up online, actually. They can go to miraclesofitaly.com for more information. And it's going to be advertised through the Padre Pio National Center. So I have a feeling that this is going to, you know, sell out pretty quick. So people want to join on an insider's look on Miracles of Italy, miraclesofitaly.com.
Miraclesofitaly.com. And you will be leading that tour.
Absolutely. And on, you know, from place to place, we'll be talking about miracles, and I'll be giving sort of the history, the background, and people will be able to ask questions, anything they want.
Yeah, you can ask questions on this pilgrimage. But, you know, these miracles are gateways to information about our faith, the history of our faith, the people of our faith, what our faith is actually about. So the miracle is just a mechanism to teach us so much about the Catholic Church. So I am so grateful for your ministry and your knowledge, Michael, and especially for sharing it with our listeners today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and please invite me back. I'd love to make this great conversation.
I will. Well, you keep us apprised of all the latest miracles. Let me know. You contact me. You say, hey, I got another miracle I want to tell you about. So stay in touch with us, Michael, and God bless you, and good luck with that pilgrimage.
God bless. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye now. Hey, we'll be right back with more talk of miracles on this Call Me Catholic. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to EWTN on the Global Catholic Radio Network.
Have you heard about Church Pop? Church Pop features new online Christian content that's fun and inspiring every day. Find it on Snapchat, Instagram, and on the web at churchpop.com.
Helping you navigate the daily struggles and blessings of life. This is Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Well, it's a miracle that we are with you today. We are talking about miracles today on Call Me Catholic. I am Peggy Normandin, and we've had a great conversation with Michael O'Neill, the Miracle Hunter, during this 160th anniversary of the apparition at Lourdes and the 70th miracle that has been performed, documented, medical miracle. So toward that theme, I thought we would revisit a testimony that I recorded of a couple that went to Lourdes, and they experienced something kind of like a miracle. So let's hear what they have to say.
I was diagnosed with leukemia in the year 2006. And despite chemotherapy, the disease came back. My parish phoned and asked me if I wanted to go to Lourdes. Apparently, the Order of Malta takes a group of people every year that are sick to Lourdes in the hope of healing some of them.
In 1858, in the grotto of Massabielle in Lourdes, France, a small market town that lies in the foothills of the Pyrenees, the Blessed Virgin Mary appeared 18 times to Bernadette Soubirous, a 14-year-old peasant girl. She identified herself as the Immaculate Conception. Lourdes has since become one of the most famous shrines in the world, attracting more than 1 million pilgrims each year. There have been thousands of miraculous cures at this shrine.
When my parish called me, I immediately said yes, but I was very skeptical of how this was going to work. The Order of Malta came out, interviewed me and my husband, and we were ultimately selected to go on the journey. When we arrived in Lourdes, there was a lot of commotion going on. There's a lot of tourists. The grottos were amazing and beautiful, and the water comes out of the grotto, and that is supposed to be the healing waters from when Saint Bernadette had her apparition with the Blessed Mother.
Wanda's husband, Robert, shares his impression.
The grotto itself, the setting of the grotto, is a very holy place. In its starkness and its simplicity and the fact that it's built into the hillside, it's just beautiful.
It was a week of events that were very beautiful. At night in the grotto, there is one of the most beautiful processions I've ever seen. You follow behind one another. In the front, there's the Blessed Mary being held up.
I think the part about the procession for me that was just beautiful was it was about 10 or 15,000 people processing at night, holding a candle, singing beautifully. It was probably the most spiritual moment, I think, for me in my entire life. And it was haunting at the same time. And just to see all those people from all over the world that were sick and had loved ones with them was one of the most remarkable moments, I think, of the whole trip.
And I saw many people weeping from the beauty of that. First of all, you're placed into carts, and somebody from the Order of Malta pulls you in these carts throughout the city. And they called us malades, which is French for sick. And you go into the cart, and that's where you stay all day during the masses and the ceremonies. And at first, I rebelled against the cart. I said, no, I'm going to walk alongside the cart. They weren't having that, so I sat in the cart and just felt very self-conscious at the beginning because the people that are surrounded near the grotto stare at you and wonder why you're in the carts and know that you're sick. In the middle of the grotto, there is a healing area where you wait to go into the water, and you're lined up probably about 2 hours before the water entrance opens. And once you are in there, you are asked to take your clothes off, and a robe is placed around you very discreetly. And you go into individual chambers that are marble. And it kind of looks like a big marble bathtub. And there are assistants on either side of you. And they take your robe off, and you sit into the water, and they dunk you into the water. You can first say prayers if you want, and they do pray over you. What I found to be one of the most amazing things at Lourdes is once you get out, you are completely dry. You go to put your clothes on, and you're not wet. You're maybe a little damp, but it's kind of like this miracle water has come over you and has dried you on its own. I felt something inside of me when I went into the water. I felt such a blessing that God was with me during that time. When I got home from being dipped into the water, I went to see my doctor. And before I left for Lourdes, they did a bone marrow biopsy, and I had disease left in the marrow.
When we returned from Lourdes, as always, we had a doctor appointment. And we never looked forward to going to the doctor. We were hoping to hear good news, but I wasn't anticipating any kind of miraculous news.
So I had another bone marrow biopsy when I got home, and I was called to come in to see the doctor. And when I got in there to the room, there were other people in. There were teaching assistants. There were nurses. I've never seen so many people in a room, and I wasn't sure why. When my doctor came in, he told me there was no disease left in the marrow. He knew I was going to Lourdes, and I asked him, "What do you think this was from?" And he said, "I think it was from Lourdes, Wanda, and I think you just had a miracle."
Hey, thanks for staying with us. Thank you, Wanda and Robert, for sharing that beautiful testimony about your trip to Lourdes. I pray you're still in beautiful health. And I pray you listeners will join us again next week, same day, same time, for more good news from our good faith. Until then, I am Peggy Normandin, but you can, you know, call me Catholic.
You've been listening to Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin, live from the Christ Cathedral campus in Garden Grove, California. Call Me Catholic is a co-production of EWTN Radio and Orange County Catholic Radio. Heard weekly on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.